Blog Talk Radio.
Hello out there to all you Metsian folk and beyond. This is Sam Maxwell, and you are here with the Metsian Podcast. And it's been an eventful last few weeks. We're glad to get on here tonight and talk some Mets baseball. Without further ado, let me bring on the Metsian Podcast panel, which is the most official I think I've ever called my my podcasting partners in crime. And let's go to Connecticut first, bring in Rich Spirago. How you doing, Rich?
Good, Sam. It's weird not to have Mets baseball on tonight, but, you know, all's good in Metsville. We have a lot to talk about, and looking forward to unpacking it.
Yeah, we do. We're obviously going to start with the freshest sound in sight, but before we do, let me bring on my my Brooklyn partner, the Brooklyn trolley blogger, as we like to call him, from Bensonhurst, Michael Colant. What's going on?
Hello, Sam. Hello, Rich. Hello, Metsville. Let's go Mets. Let's start with that.
Let's always start with let's go Mets. And by the way, that was the Metsian theme, the 86 theme as well, also known as, done by Adam Spiegel, a fellow Mets fan, and so we always like to thank him as much as possible for that. I'm going to start with you, Rich. You know, the Mets now have about like 19 or 20, I think, based off of just today alone, the way it grew from everybody talking about how it was 18, and then I think it was the Baltimore Orioles with 11. They had that many more hit by pitches than the next closest team in the major leagues. But there was also a note sent out by Major League Baseball saying that other than the Mets, it's down overall. So it can't be the balls, basically, is what they were saying. But we'll unpack that. From the Mets perspective, you know, you're waiting for somebody to really take offense. But I guess maybe the problem is that they've been taking on different teams. So you only have basically three games for all of this stuff to get pent up in some fashion. So with the Mets specifically, maybe they don't, until Nolan Arenado started something, they didn't see like their lane to take to overtly defend themselves. It's a lot to unpack. Let's start there, Rich. Beanballs, what say you?
Well, you know, to me, it's like the logical brain, the emotional brain. The logical brain tells you that the Mets aren't being thrown at. I mean, it's the ball. You know, everybody's saying the same thing. It's the ball. And that if you look at the situations where they're getting hit, I mean, last night, Marte gets hit with the bases loaded. You know, come on. They're not throwing at him in that situation. I truly don't believe that major league pitchers, with the exception of Clemens, who I think was on an entirely different plane, I don't. I mean, every now and then somebody might, you know, Pedro at one point had the reputation for being a headhunter, but it's very, very rare. And when you see a Lindor get hit in the head, Alonso get hit in the head, you don't think any of this is intentional. Okay, fine. That's the logical brain. And then you have the balls, you have the fact that it's, you know, that people don't really throw people's heads, at least they shouldn't. And then you look at but then the emotional side kicks in and you say, well, hold on a minute. You know, maybe that logical thing isn't working, because when you've been hit 19 times and the next closest team's been hit 11 times and you're such an outlier, the balls are the same for everybody. Everybody's playing under the same circumstances. Why is it so skewed to one team? And, you know, Sam, I don't know the answer. I don't know if it's just a statistical anomaly that the Mets are getting hit more than any other team. Or is it – but why? If it is intentional, why would it be intentional? You know, we're so early in the season. The Mets haven't hit other teams' players. So why would there be a reason to throw at the Mets? They don't do the, come out of the dugout for the curtain call like the 86 team. They're not brash. They're not that kind of a team. So I don't know what to make of it. I mean, I'm going to lean toward the fact that it is just a freakical anomaly, that being hit by pitch is down in baseball. The Mets are way up. They're very much an outlier, getting hit a lot. I'm going to go with it's just one of those things that happens. You know, it's like if you have a 5% chance of winning at a roulette wheel and you win. You know, it just occasionally it's that odd thing is going to happen. So I'm going to go with that. I don't think they're being targeted. I really don't. And honestly, like I said before, I think when you see the number of guys who have been hit above the shoulders, I just don't think pitchers do that, nor would they have a reason. I just think it's while the ball is the same for everybody and everybody's playing under the same circumstances, maybe this one you just can't rationally explain. That's what I'm going with. And, of course, the emotional side of me says this shit's got to stop. I mean, somebody's going to get really hurt. Can you imagine if Pete or anybody, if Lindor, they get hit in the mouth and they have, like, Dave Parker and they're out for months? And could you imagine the Mets losing a Lindor, an Alonso, a Marte, any of these guys for months? I mean, this is a real special thing that's happening. And the emotional side of me says, you know, it's got to stop. I don't want this great run to end. I don't want to start losing players to this. So that's where I am with it.
So this is pretty, you know, UFO territory, although UFOs do exist. So maybe this does too. So, Mike, I'll go to you first. My crazy conspiracy theory about it. Mets have entered new territory. The league knows it. Not to say they're necessarily top and beyond the favorites to win the World Series this year, but they have Max Scherzer now. They have Buck Showalter now. They have Steve Cohen now. Do you think any of this has something to do with all of that and the rest of the league basically not necessarily how did I just lose the word? But when contusion or not contusion, when everybody's conspiring against you, collusion. Thank you. Not to say whether it's necessarily collusion, but there does seem to be a league-wide scouting report that you should be throwing inside to the New York Mets. So, do you think any of that wacky tinfoil stuff has merit?
Yeah, I put that tweet out when they were playing the Nationals. You know, and you guys know what I always say. Once is an event, twice is a coincidence, and three times is a trend. So we're at that point. Do I think that, you know, the opposition is intentionally throwing at the Mets? No. But, Sam, you stole a little bit of my thunder because, you know, the opposition views the Mets differently now. They are a good team. They're a pretty well-balanced team, and they got a good manager, and they know what the hell they're doing now. So as a good team, you know, the opposition, they're going to up their game a little bit. And I think J.D. Davis said it very well after the game. They're going by the scouting reports and the hot zone and the cold zone. But there's so much to this. You know, we're not going to pinpoint 1, 2, 3, 5, or even 10 reasons for this. But, you know, one of the little grains of sand to this is when these pitchers are constantly throwing, excuse the term, balls to the wall, something that comes at the expense of something, and most of the time it's control. So the harder they throw, maybe the less their, you know, it lessens their ability to control it. I don't know. We're just getting theory there, but I don't think anybody's intentionally thrown at the Mets, but they have every right to be frustrated. And, you know, I don't think today's reaction was out of line. That's baseball. This has been going on a long time. Different generations have experienced it and dealt with it in different ways. So I'm not even going to go there. And, you know, they'll figure it out. What I hate is over-legislation. And that's what I fear most, that baseball intercedes in these kind of matters instead of letting them play out on the field.
Yeah, you know, that's a whole other ball game, quite possibly, but we'll see how it goes. You know, Rich, this is basically how I'll transition it. Just react to my, you know, conspiracy theory, like I was saying, as well as what the league, you know, what their involvement is. And I think I brought it up either on this podcast or the other, that, you know, it's remarkable how it's the most historical game with the most comparisons of generations, yet it might be the most uneven conditions for comparison. So the idea that the league continuously adjusts the baseball from year to year, on top of the fact that the Mets, everybody knows, are at a different level now.
I think all those things can be true. You know, from what I'm hearing, the baseballs, you heard Bassett last night, right, where he said, everybody knows the problem, Major League Baseball knows the problem, and they're not doing anything about it, they just don't care. Okay. Then Mikolas, the Cardinals pitcher, comes back with, you know, take some responsibility, dude, we're all throwing with the same balls. Okay, fair, right? It's a ball issue that they've changed the ball. They changed the ball. The ball's clearly dead now. That's the new thing. So the ball has been changed for 2022. You know, with the lowering of the seams took place last year, but the conspiracy theory with, you know, the tinfoil is that the balls were dead in this year. And now a lot of people do believe that. So there has been some altering of the ball. That could be true. The Mets are clearly, you know, they could be, and I say could be, on a San Francisco Giants-like run of just having this romp through the division like 06, 86, and like the San Francisco Giants last year, maybe. So it could be that teams are trying to, you know, intimidate them a little bit, maybe. That could factor in. That could also be true. And then there's the thing J.D. Davis said. You know, J.D. Davis said this after the game today. He said, pitchers all over try to throw to the blue zones. You know, you see it when they show the chart. The red zone is where the hitter is effective at hitting balls in those zones, and the blue zone is where the hitter is cold. And for a lot of major league hitters, the blue zones are up and particularly up and in. So the pitchers are trying to throw up and in, not just to the Mets, but a lot of hitters are vulnerable there. And because of the lack of being able to control the ball as much, the spider attack, the lowering of the seams, it just happens to hit players. All of these things can be true. They can't. And they may, in fact, they may be. It doesn't quite explain why the Mets are getting hit so much. It would explain it if there was a more even distribution of hit by pitch throughout baseball, and there isn't. So I think everything can be true, Sam. I hate to be nebulous and to be evasive, but until we know, we don't know. Everything that has been said so far in this podcast is plausible. And it could be that it's everything factors in and it's just the way it is, or maybe the Mets are being targeted. I don't think at this point there's enough evidence to point in either of those directions.
Touche. And Rich, you brought it up, and I'll go to Mike first on this, but you brought it up that, you know, a lot of these pitchers, when they're, or actually it was Mike. Mike, you brought up that, you know, they're throwing balls to the wall, like you said, and that the first thing that's going to be lost is control. Well, somebody who doesn't seem to be losing control and seems to be even more of an artist the older he gets, when he doesn't have that velocity, and that seems to be Max Scherzer. I mean, you know, I think it's understated currently, just in terms of, you know, maybe the longer he goes, the more starts he gets, we'll start talking about it. But can you remember the last time that a major league free agent for the New York Mets had this kind of a start? I mean, you know, when he was out there doing the no-hitter, I was thinking to myself, if he throws a no-hitter, this is kind of like the pitching equivalent of Gary Carter hitting a walk-off on his first home game. So Max Scherzer right now, he, the story is the Mets, but he's just absolutely marvelous.
He is. And, you know, you got a grade on the curve, and he's amongst the elite. A lot of people have packed into the middle, and the scrubs are on the left side of the curve. You know how that works. Not everyone can be Max Scherzer. That's why they're great, and that's why there's a whole population of pedestrian pitchers, you know? So the last pitcher, I think, yeah, you would have to point at Johan. But before Johan, the last pitcher that this team acquired whom we thought would have a major, major impact on the team and the standings, I think might have been Frank Viola. And we all know that didn't work out. But I remember having high expectations, bringing him here, former 20-game winner, Cy Young winner, and the team having high expectations, and it just didn't work out. But Max is Super Max. That's what makes these players stand out. Not just his performance on the mound, but look at his personality. Look how he intermingles with his teammates and the interrelationships that he's already formed, and all that character that he brings to the dugout. You know, that's what makes players special, and that's why they stand out.
Rich, you know, he was one of the direct nemesis for the Mets for the last 7 years, really, you know, and his career started with the Nationals, started, where that rivalry, which I think really started to kind of take off in some fashion in 2012, but it hit its peak in 2015, you could say. And unfortunately, within the narrative of it, the Nationals have a World Series before the Mets could get one. So it hasn't it still been kind of like a dream seeing Max Scherzer up close, up, you know, where it's we're making sure that we see every single one of the starts, and he's doing it in a Mets uniform. Doesn't it still just seem like you're on, like, this can't be real?
It totally seems that way. You know, seeing him in the Mets dugout, you know, being Mad Max, everybody saw the thing on Twitter today, where he was, you know, saying he had some choice words in there, you know, saying basically sit down, you know, to the Cardinal players in the other dugout. And just seeing him in a post-game interview in the Mets clubhouse, seeing him in blue and orange, rooting for him is weird, you know? It's like, I'm trying to think of an analogy, Mike, from our day when a rival, like, you know, the villain became a Met. I'm struggling to come up with one where someone who had just tortured the Mets became a Met. But that's exactly what it is. And so while it's strange, it's a wonderful thing to watch. I know personally the conversations I have with friends and family is we're going to go to a Max start this year. I mean, we're going to figure it out. And, you know, typically I plan my games well in advance. I'm part of a season ticket group, you know, and I pick my dates well in advance. But I'm going to find a game where it's like, okay, no rain in the forecast. Max is pitching 2 days from now. I'm going just to see Max. He's having that kind of an effect. You know, you see it. You see it on Twitter. You see it among the fan base where he really is an energizing force. And, yeah, on the one hand, it is hard to believe he's a Met because of the past. But on the other hand, it's also very exciting. And then not to mention the impact he's having on the team. You know, did you catch what Hefner said? The game that that Buck was away for the medical procedure? Hefner said, well, you know, we managed it okay. You know, we had Dickie Scott, we had myself, we had Joey Cora. You know, we were able to make the decisions. And, of course, Max wasn't hesitant about letting us know what he thought. And that was for me, that was terrible. But that's what you have. I mean, yeah, you know, let's face it, in sports, let bygones be bygones. You know, when the guy's wearing your laundry, he's your guy. And when he's as talented and as dominant and a first ballot Hall of Famer like Max Scherzer, you embrace that guy. And I think, you guys tell me what you think, it's not only bringing in a rival. I think he has energized the fan base, and I think he's helped coalesce the team.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I would agree with you on all of that. It's remarkable, and Mike, just to continue that, I had a specific point, but I'll just pass it right back over to you.
No, without a doubt, he's been a tremendously positive, person on this ball club. Tremendously positive. So I agree with everything. I'm in lockstep with you guys.
So let's talk about the overall 2022 team so far, which no other Mets team has ever started by winning their first six series. So, Rich, I'll start with you on this. What do you like about the team? What are your concerns? And do you think it's sustainable?
I'll start with the last one. I definitely think it's sustainable. Then I'll back into the other questions. And I think it's sustainable because it's a balanced team. You know, it's not – if you look at the lineup, let's start with that. So the lineup, it for some reason, tell me what you guys think. It has a 2016 Cubs feel to me because it's interchangeable parts. That's how that team won the World Series. You remember they had the Ben Zobrist. They had Baez, and they had Chris Bryant. And these are guys who they slotted in different places, you know, to try to maximize the lineup. Yes, these guys are stars, but they weren't reliant on one or two players. They had a team of interchangeable parts that worked together. That's all you hear from these guys when you hear them interview. They talk about it's all about the team. It's not about one guy, you know, and all of that. And I really do believe that. And when you have that, you know, if those one or two guys, somebody gets hurt or somebody goes cold, you're not as reliant on just one or two guys. You have a fully balanced, lengthened lineup. Look at Mark Canha. Mark Canha, here's a guy who doesn't have an extra base hit all season, but he's had a lot of big hits. And, you know, that's the kind of thing this team has. They steal bases. They have Marte. At one point, they were leading the majors with stolen bases. I'm not sure if they are now, but they score in different ways. The lineup is long. So for those reasons, I think it's definitely sustainable. And then you look at, you know, baseball is what? Insert cliche number, 80% pitching, 70% pitching, whatever number you want to say it is. The starting pitching has been outstanding. The bullpen's been okay, you know, spotty at times. If I have a concern with this team, it would be this. It would be they're getting a lot out of Tylor Megill right now, and that's great. We all love Tylor Megill. He's throwing much harder than he did last year. Clearly good, but as Buck says, we have to manage his innings. He's just never thrown. I think the most he's thrown is more. He hasn't thrown more than 130 innings. Well, starting pitchers throw about 200 now, plus postseason, God willing. So what's going to happen then? I mean, what's the plan for that? You know, you're going to start giving him five-inning starts. You're going to skip him. Who knows? Taiwan Walker. Well, okay. He's been very good, but he also went down early this season. Yes, he's coming back Saturday night, but what's his longevity? Can he survive the long season? Jake, as far as I'm concerned, sorry, guys, anything to get out of Jake is gravy. I'm not counting on anything out of Jacob deGrom at this point. I want to be proven wrong desperately. So short answer, what I think of this team is I think there's no mystery that they're doing it because they have interchangeable parts. They are a long lineup that everybody can get the job done. They have great pitching, which is the old formula. And I told you what my concern is.
Mike, you know, I guess it was, yeah, Monday night's ninth inning win. Obviously, Nolan Arenado opened the door, but it's all about making contact, putting the ball in play, not striking out as much as people do, and that's what Marcana did there. And just the way that the team got it done was both in a very team-oriented way as well as the hustle that you saw. I mean, Dominic Smith sliding in, keeping within the base path, and also reaching there before the play was, was there. It was a very team-oriented play. And I'll also end with this. Do you think the people who invented innings limits forgot about October baseball?
Who knows? You know my answer to that. Once upon a time, there was baseball, two words. And then we grew up in baseball, one word. And now we're playing modern ball. So I'm still learning this language and this whole new millennia of baseball. Anyway, batting and the collective effort. You know, we railed all last season about their approach at the plate. And, you know, a lot of players even said as much through interview, whatever have you. You know, they essentially said that their minds were polluted with too much information last season. And you see that their plate approach this season is somewhat more simplified. And I think we're seeing the results. You know, I don't want to say they threw out all the science. No, that's not what I'm saying. But when you compare perhaps their hitting approach this season with what they went through last season, prior to that, I think I see a stark difference right away in their approach. I'm not overly concerned with home runs. And look, Francisco Lindor leads the team. You know, that's gravy, but that's not my expectation. So everything right now is working well. You know, within, what, a three-week period, more or less, we've already seen a whole season worth of drama, you know. So I think this is going to continue. And as Rich said, this is indeed sustainable. So, you know, there's a lot of balance here and a lot of sustainability here. There's a lot of interchangeable parts. I like this team. I like it going forward. I still have concerns about the rotation. You know, my confidence level with Carlos Carrasco got thrown off a bit with his last outing. Otherwise, Rich, you bring up a great point about Tolly McGill. I'm just crossing my fingers and hoping that he has the stamina and the endurance to, you know, follow through with the full season. Now, you know, will they cut him off? Yeah, I'm sure. But I'm not asking for 200 innings, but we're going to have to massage that fourth and fifth spot in the rotation if, hopefully, if all goes well. You know, but we've only used seven starters to date. That's a good thing. Look back over the last couple of years, we've already been through more through the first 14, 15, 16 games or so. So we're off to a good start, Sam. I know I went off track, but we're off to a good start, and I'm happy about it.
No, you were right on the track we want. And you bring up Lindor, and that's really where the direction that I want to go. And I agree with all of you. It is sustainable. I think I've never had more confidence that an opening to a Mets season that a lot of times can feel promising. It's just all the different assets that we discussed coming together, you know, Buck and the roster, I do think is just it's one of the reasons why the Mets fan is rather confident now. But I'm certainly confident also because we're seeing the superstar that Lindor can be. And Rich, you know, I defended him because the thing that basically happened was that Lindor was bad while we were in first place. Was a major leader in that infield as well as in the clubhouse. Was probably, you know, one of the unsung heroes of keeping that team together when there were so many different places like we've just been contrasting as to where they weren't together. And it just so happened that, yes, Jacob deGrom went down, but so did Lindor in his oblique. And that's really where the shift out of first place really began. And then when he came back, it was too far gone at that point. But if you look at his numbers, basically after May, he was the Francisco Lindor that numbers-wise that he had always been. Now, I think there's a major difference. I think it's all the different personnel that we've been talking about coming together around Lindor. The pressure's a little bit off. But there's also a swagger that I don't think – maybe you started kind of seeing it when Javi Baez and him, of course, the Yankee series comes to mind last year. But there's a combination of confidence and swagger as you watch him start the year off right now. It's been a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, you know, you're sort of watching a morphing, you know, right before your eyes. I mean, you pulled a guy in, Mets pulled a guy in for the 2021 season who was a star, you know, genuine all-star, star player who was entering his prime at 27 and, you know, came to a new team, new city, all of that. I don't know if it's the big New York Ed Whitson kind of a bug thing. You know, who knows what it was. Maybe he put too much pressure on himself. Maybe it was a contract. Maybe it was New York. Maybe it was new team, new league. Who knows? It didn't work as well. And you're right. After certainly in the second half of the season, other than his injury, when he hurt his lat, we did see the Lindor that the Mets thought they were getting. And though he had, you know, two pretty bad months, so his statistics did not really land where you'd like to see them land, you could sense that. So you started to see the metamorphosis a little bit. You started to see a guy who just seemed a bit lost, let's be frank, other than defensively. Offensively, he seemed a bit lost. He talked about in spring training how, for some reason unbeknownst to him, the game seemed to speed up on him a bit. He doesn't really know why, but he just tried everything too fast. That certainly sounds to me like putting too much pressure on yourself. And then, you know, they lost him. Remember, they lost him for 6 weeks. They lost him in that first series back against Pirates, and I believe it was his first game back. And he didn't come back till late August. So, you know, and then he did quite well after that with Baez on the team and all. So you started to see the emergence of the Lindor we thought we were getting, and now this year, if you put it all together, I mean, it's not hard math to do. It's a better team, a deeper lineup like we've talked about, so he's not putting the pressure on himself to be the guy. He's more comfortable as a Met, more comfortable in New York. All of that, you're just seeing all these things come together, and he's continuing to, we'll call it, re-evolve into the Francisco Lindor who was in Cleveland. And to me, it's not, maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but to me, it's not that hard to follow. You know, if you think about everything he went through when he first became a Met and all the different pressures and the adjustments and all, plus the injury, now this year, better team, better lineup, more comfortable, doesn't have to always be the guy. While it's complicated because it's multifactorial, I don't think it's all that complicated. You know, I think he's settling in nicely. He's 28 now, and I think over the next, you know, 4 to 5 years, we're going to see, as long as he stays healthy, the guy the Mets thought they were getting. We're going to see a genuine star shortstop, and that's great. Love it.
Mike, if you don't try to be the guy, a lot of times you end up being the guy. And Lindor has been the guy at many points this year. And I think that, you know, as long as, you know, he continues to accept the challenge, you know, say what you want about Pete Alonso, obviously Jacob deGrom, we've discussed here and there. Lindor is going to be the face of this franchise for the next 10 years, basically, as long as he continues to own the challenge.
Coming to New York City is not easy. You need to get acclimated. Some players it takes, you know, a little longer than others. Some people get it right away. It all depends. Everyone's different. But he seems more comfortable now. And I will inject Buck Showalter into this conversation because I also think he's a unifying force. And a good manager empties the locker room of stupidity, nonsense, and you know, gets everyone focused on the task at hand. The good ones do that very well. And prior to Buck Showalter, we had a lot of stray personalities. That's the exact way I want to describe it. string personalities. And now that Buck is here, see, I really do think he's unified the room, got them focused. They're all singing on the same page of music. And, you know, Lindora, he's acclimated. But I also think that this comfort level provided by his experience in the city last year and with Buck Showalter on board managing the room, it also helps him, you know, go about his job. All of them. I'd be remiss if we ended this podcast and we didn't mention Starling Marte, because for whatever reason, you know, forget about what the numbers reflect right now. For whatever reason, he reminds me so much of Cliff Lloyd. And I loved Cliff Lloyd when the Mets acquired him. And I'm already getting that feeling with Starling Marte. If you guys just want to jump in.
Yeah, Rich, I'll pass it on to you right after this. But one of the most exciting players on this team right now is Starling Marte. And you were seeing exactly what we've been hoping for a long time we could as Mets fans see, and that's Starling Marte on the New York Mets.
You know, I like it. I like the analogy to Cliff Lloyd for a lot of different reasons. Now, when Cliff Lloyd came, he was a veteran, Marte's veteran, 33. I would imagine Floyd was pretty close to the same age. And Floyd definitely became a leader in the clubhouse along with Piazza. You know, perhaps in a different way, of course, you know, more of a silent leader. But Floyd was like the guy who had been around. He was kind of like the guy who kept the clubhouse right. It certainly seems like Marte does that. So, yeah, I see it. I definitely see it. And the thing is, you know, if you had to say, I don't think you could say the Mets have a certain leader in the clubhouse. Like, it's not one guy. Marte does some of it. You could definitely see that he's always answering the questions. Lindor clearly does. Pete is always on camera. So it's a variety of guys. You know, they talk to J.D. Davis, who doesn't really even play that much, but he often gets on. The pitchers are all talking all the time. So, yeah, you see leadership, but what you don't see is you don't see forced leadership. You don't see, like, where it's a David Wright, where – they always went to David Wright. He was the guy, and I can imagine it gets exhausting. Marte, I see the Cliff Lloyd thing, but I also think it's great that he's not left to be the only leader. You could see the balance in that room, and I think that's very healthy.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about Eduardo Escobar, Mike. You know, I was singing his praises as the sleeper of this lineup, that people weren't really giving enough credit what he's recently done. And the way that we're seeing Eduardo Escobar up close and personal is exactly why this is such a deep and well-balanced lineup. He's a major reason for that.
He's going to prove incredibly valuable to this team. He's going to prove it over the course of the season. There's going to be a point in the season where Mets fans are going to say, I don't want to line up without him. You know, you get that feeling. And I got nothing but positive vibes from this guy. Leads the team in doubles. And, you know, that's exciting to me. That's just more exciting than a home run, depending on the situation. But we know nothing beats a triple to right, right, Sam? But, you know, Eduardo is, he's going to be something else, man. He's going to be invaluable to this club, and he's going to show us every step of the way. He's going to be solid. He's going to be consistent. He's going to be a rock.
You know, if I could jump in on Escobar,
yeah, go ahead.
For one sec. Think about all he does. Switch hitter. He has power. He plays different positions. He could play three infield positions. Again, it's the kind of – that's what makes you sustainable. He's not just a home run hitter. He's not just a home run hitter who can't play defense or maybe can play defense. He's good defensively at three positions. He's a switch hitter. He hits for power. He hits for average. That – he's the kind of player that typifies this Mets team, I think. He might not sell. Like, he might not be the best at any one thing, but he does a lot of things to help the team. And I think it's a great, I think he's a great person to bring up, because Eduardo Escobar, to me, is exactly the kind of guy you want. He, to me, he's a 2016 Cub, and I keep going back to that, but that's what I see.
Hey, man, they won the World Series, so might as well. Rich, I'm gonna start with you again here. What do you think Eric Chavez is saying to Jeff McNeil?
I think what he's saying to Jeff McNeil is what it seems like everybody wanted to say to Jeff McNeil, the fans, you know, the broadcasters. It's like, go back to what you were in 2018 and in the beginning of 2019. It's an old cliche. You know, you get power happy, you get power hungry, you try to pull the ball and all of that. It was obvious that that's what McNeil was doing. And he has gone back to going the other way, slapping the ball around, doing what he has to do to get on base. And sure, pitcher makes a mistake to this guy, he's going to hit it out of the yard, but that's not his game. You know, I think he hit 25 home runs in 2019. And that might have been the worst thing that ever happened to him, because he's not a 25 home run guy. That was an anomalous thing. And maybe in the back of his mind, he was chasing that. Maybe with the launch angle focus and all that stuff that the prior regime seemed to have a bit more of, they didn't discourage him from doing it. You know, they said, oh, whoa, this guy might hit 25 more home runs. Let's do launch angle with him. Well, from what I understand, you know, Buck says it. You don't hear Chavez interviewed too much, but, you know, Buck says it. It's Jeff McNeil needs to go back to being Jeff McNeil. Do what you do best, which is go the other way. If the pitcher makes a mistake inside, sure, pull the ball, great. But do it, and that's what he is. That's the player he is. And he's almost like the prodigal son. You know, he's found his way back home, and he's able to succeed in that role. I would love to hear from Eric Chavez. I don't know if you guys have heard from him. I've never heard him interviewed. Maybe he's saying something, but there's definitely a buzz. Buck says it all the time. I've heard Buck say it several times, that with McNeil, the thing is to keep him focused on being the player that got him to the big leagues, and that's clearly what's happening, and I love it.
Mike, you know, now that he knows that he has the capabilities of the power. Hopefully, you know, so far this is what we've seen, that yes, he can hit it out of the yard when he wants. And the fact that that's also something Jeff McNeil can do has made him a more balanced hitter once his approach has changed and gone back to the approach that he had, you know, because the 24 home runs, 25 home runs that he hit in 2019, the majority of them came in the second half. There was clearly an uptick while his average was starting to tick down. And I think he hit like something crazy low, like 242 in the second half there. So a properly balanced Jeff McNeil, I will accept a lower batting average if he does have his power, just not to the extent that he had when he was thinking about the launch angle. So, Jeff McNeil, go ahead, Mike.
You know, Lenny Dykstra drove the Mets insane over the same thing. You know, and Keith Hernandez would say, Lenny, just hit singles and doubles. You're doing great. And Lenny would say, hey, only home run hitters make the big bucks. You know, so, yeah, hitters can stray and stray away from the things that, you know, got them noticed in the first place. We don't know what goes through their minds. Everyone's different. Jeff McNeil, you know, in his mind, he might feel like he's still fighting and competing for a job. He still doesn't have, you know, a full-time assignment. And sometimes, you know, that interferes with how you go about your craft. I hope he finds value in getting on base, and I believe hitting for high average is still important in the game. And, you know, not worry about home runs, because we've all known that if you put a good swing on the ball, it has a good probability going out. Launch angle is a myth. You know, it's just a shortcut to a strikeout, if you ask me. You know, tell that to Stan Musial and listen to me. But, you know, Met fans and the Mets themselves, they've been down this path with Lenny Dykstra. But he was too stubborn. Hopefully, Jeff McNeil is a little bit more humble in his approach, and he sticks with what works. And what we need from him is exactly what he's doing, as you say, Sam, and hopefully, you know, it works out. It works out to the, you know, team's satisfaction.
You are listening to the Metsian podcast, and, you know, it's been a while since we got on air, so there's just a few things from earlier in the season that we would like to talk about, but I want to go around first before we move on. Is there anything else that we want to hit? Go ahead first, Rich.
Well, we've covered the lineup. We know we've covered the key. I think, you know, the Jacob deGrom news might be worth a mention. I mean, clearly, you know, he's on everybody's mind. And I don't know, I'll just say this about it. I don't know if you guys can make heads or tails out of the report that came out on Monday night that the MRI showed significant healing and that he could begin load bearing and strengthening and load increasing or whatever the exact terms are, and then be reevaluated in 3 weeks. I don't know what that means, frankly. Obviously, it doesn't say throw a baseball. Does that mean he's going to lift weights? Does that mean he's going to, you know, use the bands and stretch and just, you know, gradually increase how much he's stretching, how much resistance? Is that what it means? You certainly don't get the impression they want him throwing a baseball. And what does that mean? Does that mean that they're just being overly cautious and what's 3 more weeks? And if that's the case, I don't blame them. Or does it mean that maybe it's not as significantly healed as they want us to think it is? I don't know. It just seems weird that they said 4 weeks of total shutdown, and I believe that's actually today or yesterday, 4 weeks of total shutdown. And, okay, we did that. And based on what they said, you know, does this mean 3 more weeks of no throwing a ball? And if that's the case, it's one of unless there's another outcome I'm not seeing, it's one of two things. B, maybe they're being truthful and they just want to be super duper cautious. And if he comes back middle of June or early June, what's the difference? You know, let's just make sure he's healthy. Okay. Or is there something that they're concerned about that has altered this plan and they want to see in 3 weeks how it holds up? I don't know. And at this point, as fans, I think I don't see how any fan could be counting on Jacob deGrom this season. I would love nothing more than to be pleasantly surprised by him making, you know, 12 to 15 starts, bolstering the rotation. You know, we talked about our concerns about the rotation depth, but I just think, who knows? Monday's news seemed very anticlimactic to me because I expected it to be up, you know, it really wasn't the scapula. He needs rotator cuff surgery, which would be horrible. Or he healed. We're going to get him on a throwing program. But it was this nebulous thing that just, to me, conjures up more questions. I don't know where you guys are with it.
Mike, you know, it's sad that I've gotten this cynical about it to say the following. But should they just rename the MRI machine after Jacob deGrom?
Oh, boy. So far as this topic, the less I know, the better. Rich is right. I don't want to hear it. All I want to hear is that he's ready to go and he's going to start Tuesday. That's what I want to hear. I don't want to hear speculation. I don't want them feeding us good news, bad news, or otherwise. Just, you know, let him go about his recovery. But I don't need these little tidbits of information. I don't need to get fed that. Less I know, the better. Renaming it the deGrom. Well, you know what? Let's hope not. Let's hope not. Hopefully there's a lot more baseball left in that right arm.
Very much so. You know, Jacob deGrom, you know, he wants to pitch. Like, you always see how annoyed he is about all of this stuff. You know, and we're at the point that we weren't at the time of Sandy Koufax, where he would wake up with his arm completely black and blue. You know, this is a different era, modern ball, as Mike has said. So, Yeah, Rich, I have to agree with you. You know, whatever you can get is gravy for sure. And I think this is a good segue to another Cy Young, multiple Cy Young award-winning pitcher for the New York Mets, Tom Seaver, since we haven't been on air since the Tom Seaver statue was unveiled. And forget about the games that we missed, all of that. You know, obviously Gil Hodges was also honored that Saturday. But, Rich, I'll start with you. Have you been to the ballpark? Have you seen it up close? What's going on?
Yes and yes. I was at the ballpark the day after, Saturday, the second home game. And I think we were literally the second or third car in the parking lot because I wanted to make sure I got enough close look. And it really is as good as you've heard people say it is. The detailing on it is great. You know, the leg, the drop and drive looks exactly right, like Mike, we remember from our youth. The facial part is great. I think they did a good job, very good job, making it look like him. It's in a great place. It's by the Apple, so it's a great place to gather with friends and, you know, take a picture or whatever. Of course, we had questions because there's like a short fence around it, maybe a 4-foot high fence. What happens in the middle of the night? Do people get off the subway? Can they just go there, hop the fence, and touch it? I don't know. Do they cover it? I don't know what they do, but that's my only question about it. I think I do want to say it was worth the wait. I think we waited way too long, but it's so good that we'll say that it was worth the wait. Like I said, it's in the right place in the ballpark. It's immaculately done. It needed to be done. You know, for those of us who travel around to the different ballparks, you see in San Francisco, they've got McCovey. You see in St. Louis, they've got Mutual. They've got Clemente in Pittsburgh. The Mets had to do it to their guy, who was one of the best pitchers in the history of the game. It's finally done. Who cares about the past? It's great. My recommendation to anyone would be next time you go to Citi Field, go early so you can go over to it. You know, it's over by where they planted all the flowers too, so that's kind of cool. Spend the time, get close to it, get as close as you can, get a good look at it, take some pictures. It's absolutely worth the trip, and it's very well done. And yes, I'm happy that I got my Seaver replica statue at that game, and it's something that I put in my bobblehead case, so I'm pretty happy about that.
Yeah, I really want to get my hands on one of those. Rich, before I move it over to Mike, I'm wondering, those barriers, I did see that, and I was wondering whether they're ever going to remove them. I mean, do you know any, like you were saying, that, like, you know, does that mean at night, like, people can jump the barriers or whatnot, but are they eventually going to get rid of it? I mean, you'd think that it would just be incorporated into the plaza where people could even sit on the mound, if you will. And it is sloped, which I thought was really cool.
It is. And it's just natural questions you have. And we were all saying the same thing, you know, because we all went over, we being all the fans, people are over there taking pictures and all that. And then you get in line because it was a giveaway day. And that's what people are talking about. What are they going to do with this thing in the winter? Are they going to cover it? You know, it is going to snow on it. I mean, what are they going to do with that? Is that going to have a negative impact? Are they going to take it inside in the winter, you know, and put it on like, a big old dolly and, you know, or several dollies and wheel it into the rotunda? Who knows what the plan is? And again, I don't know. I don't know what they do with it in the middle of the night. You know, do they have cameras? Do they have security around it? I don't know. But I just hope that they preserve that thing to the best of their ability because it's something that's generational, you know? You know, I took my daughter on Saturday, the second game, and if someday I have grandkids, I want to bring my grandkids with my daughter, and I hope that thing lasts forever. I really do. It's totally worth it. But, right, it just conjures up questions as to, will the barriers stay? Will they go? How do they protect this thing from weather, from humans? You know, I don't know.
So, Mike, you know, I think this was, I heard that this is the first pro sports statue in New York City history. Is that correct?
Could very well be. I'm not aware of any others. Yankee Stadium has plaques and monuments, but no statues. So if you take into consideration all the sports, no, this is indeed the first statue.
Yeah, and so I think like it seems as if we don't know what to do. Like, you know, this is the first sports statue. What do we do? Do we have to keep, you know, guard on it all the time? It's probably going to look really pretty in the snow, but, go ahead.
New York is, it all depends on New York. We can't have nice things, they say, right? But it's a statue, and it's made for the weather. Rich, you brought up Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh has their statues scattered all around. You know, Roberto Clemente is in the left field corner where left field meets the bridge out on the sidewalk, and then you got Willie Stargell down the block. Over by home plate, you got Honus Wagner, Bill Mazeroski. Inside the park, you got Ralph Kiner's hands, of all things. You know, so they're scattered throughout. And it's fun, you know, having to go chase them down. But they're meant to be outside. You know, Philly, theirs are outside in the parking lots. They're big. They're tremendous. They're made to be out there 24/7 throughout the year in all kinds of weather. They withstand the test of time. They were meant to, stand for a long time for a good reason, for a good man, for good people. That's part of the power invested into these art projects with granite, you know, and bronze. How they take care of it, it's going to take care of itself, you know, like every other monument that was erected for, you know, the goodness and greatness of people.
So, Rich, the next question is always, you know, what next? What's up? What's up after Tom Seaver? So I will throw a name out there for a statue wishing, and that's Joan Payson.
Well, it's hard to argue. Gil Hodges, hard to argue. I think if, Mike brings up a good point. Several ballparks have several statues. You know, it's not just one and done. I don't know where I stand on that. I mean, is it that, you know, do you keep Seaver alone for a couple of years, 5 years, so as to give him his place in history, and then do another, or do you do one every 5 years, you do one every year? I don't know. But I think if you were going to do another wave, to me, in the next wave, the priorities would be Payson and Hodges. I don't see how you can't. Payson, for obvious reasons, there wouldn't be the Mets without Miss Payson. And without Hodges, you know, we all know what he meant to the team and all of that. And then if you go even farther than that, you know, to me, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, down another rung on the ladder, you know, my fourth one would be Rusty Staub. And I know – He played for the Mets, I think, a total of like 6 or 7 seasons. His first go around, he was a star. He got hurt the first year, but he 73, great in 76. When you think about the pinch hitting and all of that, you know, a lot of people say you don't put up a statue of a guy who's a pinch hitter. But then it's all the off the field stuff. It's all the work he did for the New York City police and firefighters and their families, you know, those who were lost in line of duty. Everything he meant to the New York area, not only the Mets. He would be the first one of the next rung down after Payson and Hodges. That's the way I see it. But I want to know what the plan is. I wish I could have a coffee with Steve Cohen and ask him. If he said no, you know, Seaver's the guy. When you think of the Mets, think of Seaver. We're stopping here for the foreseeable future. I would understand that. I would. And if he said, no, we're not stopping there. 3 years from now, 5 years from now, you're going to see Payson, Hodges, whatever it is. I'd be okay with that, too. I think there's a plausible argument either way, and I wish I knew the plan, but I don't.
Mike, do you think that the Mike Piazza statue would have to have, like, basically start, basically would have to for me, you'd have to sketch it out of his home run follow-through, that with his bat on its shoulder before he brings it back up. That's, to me, the ultimate image I have of Mike Piazza in my brain from that era.
I'm down with that. However which way they do decide, you know, to create a statue for him, if and when. The Mets need to figure out a way to bring this all together, because right now, you know, I'm sorry to have to bring this up, but you know me, Sam. Things are quite segmented at Citi Field because of who? The former ownership. You have Siva Way all by itself, and you have to cross the street in order to see it, you know, in all its glory. But what are you doing? You're crossing the street into nothing, into a barren, empty lot, you know, and down the way is where the statue is. So before they do anything else, they need to come up with a plan on how to harmonize and you know, get all this history and where they're going to position everything and get Citi Field more in tune with our metropolitan sensibilities as opposed to those Dodger sensibilities that a former owner used to have. I'll go back to the Phillies. Look, out on the left field concourse, just before you exit the place and go into the parking lot, they have a statue of their announcer. I think it's life-size as well. So you can get pretty creative. I'm totally down with Joan Payson. I'm totally down with Joan Hodges. I'm with Gil Hodges, Joan Hodges. What a slip, huh, Sam? But I'm totally down with Gil Hodges and Joan Payson. Yeah, right? and, you know, you can be real creative where, what and where you put them. You know, what you're going to do to honor them and where you're going to place it. You know, maybe Joan Payson could meet us at the top of the stairs and the escalators in the rotunda. You know, I'm just making things up. Maybe one day we could, maybe, I don't know, maybe the Piazza statue could be out in center field. They have that big, vast expanse, you know, and right now they got the kids' corner with the bat. But, you know, you could put something right in the center of that and people just walk around and mingle and hang out there. The Phillies did that with Richie Ashburn. They used to do that in center field. So I just think they need to be creative and integrate all of this history with Citi Field and, you know, harmonize it and make it come together. Either that or Mr. Cohen demolish the place and rebuild it. That would be the only other solution. And I don't put
Hey, you know me. Way. I'd be down. Sunnyside Yards is waiting for them. Long Island City would be a great downtown ballpark. Just saying. Will Puns missed the boat on that one. But you have been listening to the Messian podcast. I was going to just say, if there's anything else, you know, do the whole going once, going twice. But, Mike, what were you about to say?
No, I was just going to reiterate. I just find a little what's the word I want to use? A little disturbing that Siva Way and the statue are so separated from themselves. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's the Siva Way was done under the, I believe, the old ownership. And but the statue has to be where it is. That's for sure.
Oh, I agree.
So is there anything else on the docket, guys? Going once? Going twice? Sold to the last word, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, as always, for listening to the Metsian podcast. And we are going to go around for our final word. And why not some shameless plugs along the way? So we'll start with Mike Lacolin.
Mike Lacolin, the Brooklyn Trolley blogger. I'm redoing the 1890 Brooklyn Bridegrooms regular season. So if you're interested, pay a visit. and I'll be going through it game by game. Shameless plug. Final word, Sam? Let's go Mets. I'm just a happy camper. This is one of the best starts to a season ever. So I'm just enjoying it. You know what I always say, you can't win pennants in April, but you can certainly lose them. Well, they're making a nice cushion for themselves should something go awry in the summer months.
That is true. Thank you, Mike. And let's go to Rich for his shameless plug and final word.
All right. Well, a shameless plug would be I'm with the Mesmerize online site. I do the history pieces. There's insider information. There's one dropping tomorrow on the famous Mike Piazza walk-off against Trevor Hoffman, now to make us all feel really old. That took place 23 years ago tomorrow. So there's going to be a piece on that on Mesmerize. And, again, I do the history and, like, the business of baseball stuff. And then my final word would be exciting. Let's face it, folks. This is an exciting New York Mets team. We haven't had this in a while. So if you told me 14-6 after 20, I'd have said, where do I sign for that? So it's exciting. It's a great run. We don't know how long it's going to last. We can hope it lasts all year. But let's enjoy this exciting baseball.
Thank you, gentlemen, and I am Sam Maxwell. I do Bedford and Sullivan, the story of Brooklyn and its ball club. You can check that out. Podcast, we've had a lot of awesome people on it, including Mike LeColant, of course. So check out that. That's my shameless plug. And final word, baseball, because 10 years ago, I was as happy as I am now to have baseball back, but I definitely feel that was a surprise happiness to the beginning of the way the Mets were starting 2012 off, right? And there's a drastic difference between that feeling just enjoy it while it lasts to what's going on right now is palpable between the two seasons 10 years apart. And this is basically, you would have those fleeting moments with the Wilpons of some great baseball moments. However, you just knew that they were fleeting and you held on to them, and the Wilpons played into that Mets, vibe of you gotta believe, but did it in such this underdog shirt that they handed out, that underdog way wasn't exactly, you can't just brand it black and white. Like, there's intangibles that we are starting to see as a franchise. And that is why baseball is my final word, because one way or another, I am always happy to have baseball back. But this feels like we could be on the precipice of something special, whenever that may happen. But something is in the air. Last year was kind of a halvesies year, where we saw that arc of transition between the two generations of Mets baseball. And it's so awesome to see such a clear line of demarcation between 2021 and 2022. So here's to it continuing, and let's go Mets. Thanks, everybody. Take care. Later, Rich. Later, Mike.
Later. Good night. Let's go Mets.